Hello, Internet. This is David Rovix, and you are tuned in to another episode of Discussions with David, which is these days a broadcast that I'm doing at this time, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in London, pretty much every Wednesday and Friday these days. And then on Tuesday, I'm the host of Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby, which also happens at the same time on generally the same platforms, which include my Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and other platforms, as well as the Facebook pages of KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, and Popular Resistance, based out of the DC, Maryland area. And all of these broadcasts also get turned into podcasts, which you can find if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform, or go to davidrovix.com or get the David Rovix mobile app. I'll be, just to mention, doing a couple of special broadcasts this weekend. On Saturday, I'll be broadcasting my recording session at Big Red Studio in Corbett, Oregon, for pretty much the entire afternoon. And then on Sunday, I'll be doing a concert at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern at the New York City Anarchist Book Fair, which this year is an online event at anarchistbookfair.net. Today, I have the great pleasure of speaking with somebody who I've known at least on a once or twice a year basis for many, many years in London, England, in Walthamstow, longtime host of the Walthamstow Folk Club in London, accomplished traditional musician, banjo player, and also more recently the author of a book which has so much relevance today. Written about the events that took place in 1949 in Peekskill, New York, which became known in shorthand as the Peekskill Riots. My friend Bob Steck, who was in the Abraham Lincoln Battalion, was doing security at the riots there. So I've heard a lot about those days in 1949, firsthand and secondhand as well. And I read Russ's book, I guess now over a year ago, and it was just a fantastic read. And it's wonderful to have you with us, Russ Chandler.
Hello, David.
London, England.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Good. And that book, this is a legendary event around here. And I guess that's, you kind of have maybe a bit of an advantage being from England writing this book, because I don't think it's quite such a legendary event in England. I don't know. But here it's like, especially on the left, it's like, it's this one of these really big oversized kinds of events in history. And then your book was, I guess I've read a fair bit about it, but your book was the first one that to me really made the whole thing three-dimensional and put it into historical context, and also like helped me to understand who these people were, like, because I knew who the communists were, they were my friends, or their parents, but who were these other people, but I also wanted to ask you about how things are going in London and with the folk clubs and the, or the lack thereof. Yeah. But we could go any. But let's start with the pandemic and the Walthamstow. You've been hosting the Walthamstow Folk Club for decades, and this is probably the first time in many decades that it's suddenly not happening for months on end.
Yeah, absolutely. The Folk Club itself has been running since the early 1990s, and I got involved, frighteningly enough, about 16 years ago now. So I've been booking it for 15 years, and certainly this is the first time we've ever had a break beyond just having the summer off. And it's been a disaster. We tried to keep it going, but we couldn't do it. The venue is struggling, and of course it was simply shut down. It would have been illegal to run it for a while, so we have pulled the plug for the foreseeable future.
How is the venue surviving? The venue, because as some people know, of course, and others don't, so many of these folk clubs in England are actually taking place in sort of the function room of a pub or an arts center or some kind of a venue, so that the folk club isn't the one itself usually keeping the venue open, and these rooms are getting harder and harder to find and to
That's absolutely correct. When I was over in the States a couple of years ago doing some music, it was some of the New York folkies were very surprised to find out that British folk clubs happen in pubs and everybody has a drink on the whole time.
And they don't have to sit in a church basement.
That's right.
Feeling vaguely penitent as they're trying to enjoy some good music.
But the pubs have had an awful hit during the pandemic. Our pub, which is the very wonderful Rose and Crown, which is a wonderful community pub with a beautiful theatre function room upstairs, which they let us have for free. But they had to close down during the lockdown. And unfortunately, the company that own the land did not do them any favors. So they were having to spend something like £20,000 a month just to pay the rent on a on a building they couldn't open. They did a crowdfunder to try and keep themselves going through the worst of the lockdown. I think they wanted £30,000, and I think they got something like £150,000 from the local community, because we all love that pub very much and we can't bear the idea of this place without it.
And the money that they're raising is, just to be clear, mainly going to pay the landlord usurious amounts of money during the lockdown pandemic. Yes. And the government isn't stepping in to do anything about that?
No, I understand it. No, there hasn't been any help for a business like that. There has been help for other businesses, I understand, and there are loans and so on, but there was nothing that they could do. They reopened recently. They do everything they can to be safe. It's restricted entry, table service. I've been in there a few times. I'm, to be honest, not that convinced it's that safe, even though they're doing absolutely everything right. You only need someone to sneeze 15 yards from you and you're going to be in trouble. But the worst problem is that, like any of these venues, if they've got socially distanced restriction of numbers and table service, they can't make the money to pay the rent. And the fact that they've just introduced new restrictions, meaning pubs have to close at 10 o'clock, the reason they've done that is because that's when pubs are at their most busy. So they're taking away the bit, especially on a Friday and a Saturday, where most pubs make their profit or make their money for the week. So it's a dreadful, dreadful situation. Rose and Crown are hanging on in there. Their landlord, Bun — did you ever meet Bun, David?
Not sure.
You might have said hello to him when you were in there, but he's actually caught COVID and has been on a ventilator.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's absolutely dreadful. They are really struggling, those guys. And yeah, on behalf of everybody, we just wish them all the best, because we love them to bits and they're part of what make this little bit of Northeast London worth living.
And another thing we seem to have in common between England and the US, other than this crazy, fairly incompetent government response to the economic situation, is the really lack of competent response to the virus. I mean, we're like, I think the US is number one and the UK is number five in terms of like the worst virus situation in the world.
Yes, the response has been absolutely inadequate and continues to be inadequate. They have a problem. Viruses like this, pandemics like this, are not compatible with capitalism. What it demonstrates is, during the initial moments of lockdown, it goes to show what people can do when they come together. So we threw up hospitals. They called them Nightingale hospitals, brand new hospitals thrown up in a matter of weeks. Just goes to show what people can do when they need to. The only problem with that is if you need someone to cream a bit off the top, and then it all gets very complicated. You know, the in this country, the National Health Service, which has been absolutely magnificent and is always under threat from people who don't like the idea of people getting health care and somebody else not making a profit out of it. But we had these wonderful moments where people would come outside every Tuesday, I think it was, or maybe it was every Thursday, and applaud all the NHS workers around. That's what they did during the lockdown. At the end of the day, though, their most important priority is getting people back to work so that their friends can start making money out of them.
Because London, I mean, especially when you think about London, it is such a precarious — it's such a precarious city. It's so there's such super exploitation of so many people, and real estate and the rents, and there's just so many people just struggling to barely survive and hang on. And then the mayor's response recently, I read in the Guardian, was to talk about freezing rent, for the next 2 years. And how out of touch reality is this guy? I mean, I also read that London, rents are actually being slashed by 20% by landlords that are trying to find tenants. Because, yeah, of course, in this densely populated megalopolis, naturally, quite sensibly, people are fleeing the city during the pandemic. But the mayor's freeze on rents and the actual slashing of rents by 20%, and then on top of that, the actual suffering of the people of London. I mean, all of these things just seem like totally, like, what planet are these people on?
I think it's worse than that, because London, although we're having an increase, London hasn't been too bad in terms of the prevalence. It's creeping up now, but over the last couple of months since the lockdown, we've not been too bad. It's been a lot worse in towns up north like Leicester and Birmingham, small northern towns. And the reason for that...
Only a Londoner would call Birmingham a small northern town.
Yeah, I was thinking perhaps that's not correct. I apologize to you now for all the people from Birmingham who are about to get on the comments and complain. That was a slip of the tongue. I was thinking of Leicester and Bolton and places like that, and also massive sprawling metropolises like Birmingham. But the reason they're paying particular hotspots is because they have very low-paid populations and they have sweatshops. Now, London's got its problems, but they think the reason the prevalence has been low is that London isn't particularly different. Many people in London have found that they can work from home or that they can work in delivery jobs, but we're not tending to be pressed together into sweatshops because there's no bloody industry in London anymore. But the places where there's industry, the virus has just ripped through it. Because there's no social distancing, and you know, it's as always, it's the poorest people live most densely together. They have the least options in how they work, and they're the most vulnerable to this pandemic.
Yeah, right. And even to the extent that some of the countries that have done really well comparatively, like Germany and Singapore, the weak points in those countries have been the same kind of thing with people working in industry, especially migrant workers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think, let's start getting into peak skill here.
yes, enough of all this laughter and good fun.
enough of all this having a laugh at the pandemic. Let's let's talk about fascists. This is
both products of late capitalism, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
And pandemics and fascists,
right? And there's these patterns that have to do with big wars and then reactions afterwards in terms of both movements for liberation and movements against sort of blowback kind of opposition to liberation of different groups that happened. This pattern from the First World War, the Second World War is very clear. But I mean, I was trying to figure out, even just like for people who might not be familiar with events in Peekskill in 1949. First of all, I want to get you to just give us a synopsis of what happened before we talk about it. But also, even just setting the stage for it is hard to figure out. Easier perhaps for an historian, but it's just like, where do you even begin? I mean, at least with the Great Depression, perhaps. Because, like, when I think about the people involved with the Paul Robeson concert and the communists of New York and the left in New York generally, it was hugely popular. Across society, it wasn't just a pigeonholed little thing. I mean, the New Deal was tremendously popular, right? Mm-hmm. And fighting against fascism also was tremendously popular. Although there was a lot, it was contentious. It was a war, and everything. But then, that was the way I would kind of set the stage. Is like this is kind of where we're coming out of, and then I don't know. Where would you start?
Well, it's never good to center too much on one individual, but I kind of trace the story through the story of Paul Robeson. And again, many of us will know who Paul Robeson is, but actually a lot of younger folks especially don't know who he is.
Right.
Very remarkable singer and activist who was probably, I think I say in the book, by the mid-1940s, he was probably the most famous black man on the planet. an astonishing singer, a great actor, first black man to play Othello on the stage, incredibly well educated, and hugely famous. But I think in terms of the story of Peekskill, a good place to start it is, as you say, in the New Deal in the mid-1930s. And then comes the war. And what you find is there was a massive upsurge in working class confidence thanks to the New Deal. And then through the economic expansion of the Second World War. So when we come to the end of the Second World War, you have very confident trade unions. You have very confident left. There were massive strikes in 1945 to 1946 in places like the motor industry in Chicago. I can't remember the exact details. There was a very militant, very strong working class. And Paul Robeson and the left was very much a beacon in this. You look at Paul Robeson, you look at Pete Seeger, you look at the Almanac Singers. And these weren't necessarily household names, although with something like the Weavers, they were definitely moving into being household names. Paul Robeson was definitely a household name.
Yeah.
He was world famous. My grandfather loved Paul Robeson.
He was famous as an athlete even before he became famous as a public figure, like as a political figure and a musician.
Yeah, he was, right? I think, the first black man to play college football. He really was amazing, and the racism he suffered was absolutely
terrible,
sulfurous. He would other teams would refuse to line up against them because they wouldn't play with a black man in them. He taught himself law, and on his first day as a lawyer, his secretary walked out because she refused to take dictation from a black man. And I think what happened was that you started to get tensions between the US establishment, and especially under Truman, who were looked from the Soviet Union, which had been an ally during the war, but they started to reinterpret the Soviet Union as their primary international competitor, as the Soviet Union tried to grow its economy. And from that, they also needed, of course, to discipline the workforce and to tone down this wave of militant industrial action, which is why you get the law, which the name temporarily escapes me, but they passed a law called... I should know this, shouldn't I?
Is this the sedition?
Yeah, this is the Taft-Hartley Act.
Oh, yeah.
Which is was a
1946?
47, yeah.
47, which is just like, I think that is, yeah, that cannot be overemphasized in terms of how much of a devastating impact that had on the ability for people to organize, right? Because it's like that it made solidarity strikes illegal, right?
Yes. Secondary picketing was calling off periods. Secondary picketing was illegal. And it basically eviscerated the communist left within the American trade union movement. And some unions which had been hotbeds of militancy actually became hotbeds of anti-communist activity. If you combine that with something like the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, which again, this is McCarthy. And people know, I think, a lot about McCarthy. They know about what happened to Paul Robeson, what happened to Pete Seeger, what happened to the Hollywood 10. But it actually ruined the lives and careers of tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of ordinary people. And this was all part of a move to focus, to remove any kind of communist or Soviet influence from American politics, not necessarily for ideological reasons, but because, as I say, they viewed the Soviet Union as their main imperial competitor.
And it really, this whole thing really kicked in pretty much immediately following the Second World War, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, people associate McCarthy with the 1950s, but it really was just an immediate, like, okay, now we were allied with the Soviet Union, and now we're definitely back to being enemies.
And there was nothing organic about it. It was a decision. It was an absolute stone-cold decision. Now, this led to a situation, and we'll get onto the fun bit in a minute with the punching out and the gasplatting, but just to go through the background, the tensions within American society at that point, especially racial tensions, which Paul Robeson was very much involved with, led to a point where he went to the Paris Peace Accord, a conference in Paris in 1949. And he said that he did not see, or it was reported that he said, that he basically thought that black people should not join, the black Americans should not join the American armed services in order to take up arms against people who'd done them no harm, in support of people who were basically lynching them in very large numbers and discriminating against them. This is what caused, this was the touch paper that lit the fuse for the Peekskill riots as a specific thing, because the American left had held annual concerts around Peekskill. And Peekskill is in upstate New York, sort of on the way to Poughkeepsie, if anybody doesn't know. And it's on the banks of the Hudson River, about an hour's drive from New York City. And various left organizations had had regular summer concerts there with the likes of Pete Seeger, Paul Robeson, for several years, and they had been extremely popular. And
that's another thing to really emphasize about this in terms of the geography, right? Because we're not talking about Alabama. I mean, we're not even talking about Maryland or something. I mean, we are talking about the heart of, to some extent, the heart of the American left, right? I mean, it's not Absolutely. New York City, but it's a place that for generations had been basically, maybe it, from the viewpoint of some of the locals, maybe colonized by urban leftists. But it had been going on so long that this was also like, I mean, I grew up around there in Connecticut in that in general area. And I know there's this contention between the sort of weekenders or the sort of urban leftists that come up for the summer, and the locals who are trying to eke by in some rocky little farm.
Well, there was certainly, there was a tension, and a lot of people talk about the tension between what the colonies, which are basically leftist holidaymakers having a weekend away. There were lots of colonies. There were anarchist colonies and Jewish colonies and socialist colonies.
They called them colonies? I didn't realize that. Oh, wow.
Yes, I don't know why, but they do.
It's distressing.
And they didn't mix much with the locals. That hadn't caused any particular problems in previous years. But I think there is a misconception that the racism in the States was a Southern phenomenon. And certainly lynching was more of a Southern phenomenon. And there was a horrible wave of lynching immediately after the Second World War, which was really a response to black soldiers coming back from the war and actually expecting to be treated with some respect and with some decency. And they were met with a tree and the rope.
And this was all over the country, that the wave of lynchings post-war, or was it?
Lynchings were more features of Southern states. But the idea that it was purely a Southern state, this kind of systematic, brutal racism was exclusively Southern, doesn't stand up to examination.
No, and Oklahoma in 1921, that wasn't in the South either. Oklahoma's the West, and that was one of the most horrible examples of racism.
Yes. But if you look in 1946, in New Jersey, there was a famous case called the Trenton Six, which is where a shop worker, William Horner, was murdered. And the police basically randomly rounded up six black people, put them on trial for their lives. I love this quote. This is a quote from their defense lawyer. Now, this is their defense lawyer, I emphasize, not the prosecution. So in order to get them off this capital charge, he said, "These men, whose great-grandfathers were brought here as wild men, and these people had all the natural fears of the place they had just come from, just the way your little dog, if he doesn't know someone, he regards them askance." This is the defense lawyer. And these guys were convicted by an all-white jury and sentenced to death. And that is then people said that's Northern style lynching. That was 1946, and that was New Jersey. That's right in the heart of where you would not normally expect that kind of thing. Certainly, there was no great sort of Ku Klux Klan tradition around that part of New York. But
the Klan was very popular in the North and other parts of the North for sure. Yeah.
But Yeah, and there was, as well as the idea that late 1940s US was this world of picket fences and cars with enormous fins, which it might have been for some people. But
for some, right? But
the
not
area
for
around
others.
Northern New York State mm-hmm. was very depressed, especially around Pigskill. It was a one industry town, which was the Fleischmann Yeast Factory. And it laid off 700 of its workers right around this time, about 1949. Because of the Taft-Hartley law, which we can collective bargaining, a lot of the businesses moved to the South where they could exploit cheaper labor. And so you had a very depressed, there was an economic decline around Pigskill, which if you combine that with a narrative of unpatriotism, an anti-establishment narrative, which had been pushed onto Robeson, you can see why this was a tinderbox happening. This Pigskill concert was ready to go. So it was the 27th, I think, of August, 1947. Sorry, 1949. And there was simply going to be a concert for the People's Songs Collective, I think it was, with Robeson, and I think Pete Seeger was involved, and some classical musicians, which they had done many times before. However, there were some rumblings. The local press were hostile rather than being supportive as they had been before. But the concert, as it went ahead, as they were setting it up, it was in the Lakeland Picnic Grounds, which was a natural bowl. It's all gone now. You can't go there. There was a natural bowl with one narrow dirt road that led down to it. So as they were setting it up, all of a sudden, the organizers who were setting it up, which is a group of men, women, they had a stage and a PA and all that sort of thing, were attacked. This was before people came in, but they were attacked by hundreds and hundreds of men armed with clubs and brass knuckles and rocks, who rushed along the entrance road, trapping their way out, and proceeded to stone and attack the organizers.
And who were these guys? I mean, that's a lot of your book is exploring that. But yeah. I guess you're setting the stage, and then you'll get more into who these people were and yeah. how they were organized. And
absolutely. And this was there was a combination of organized and spontaneous matters. But this was a right wing mob. Let's put it at that. A lot of them had American Legion caps on.
American Legion. That goes. What did the police do? Were the police around? I mean, this is just reminding me so much of Portland 2 weekends ago.
At this point, because they were just setting up the concert, there wasn't a police presence yet. Having said that, they did call the police immediately and repeatedly and got absolutely no response whatsoever from them. They left them there. The role of the police will become more clear, I think, as we look at the second incident, the second riot.
The big one.
Yeah, the big one. The first one is the frightening one, because they were small numbers of people. They were trapped. They ended up using their coach as a mobile barricade to try and keep them away from the rocks, whilst this mob smashed up the table, smashed up the PA, and set a bonfire going. And then over the grounds, they saw in from the hills overlooking the bowl a big burning cross. So there was definitely Ku Klux Klan. There was definitely Klan activity there. So they basically managed to barricade themselves on the stage whilst this riot around it kind of burnt itself out. Amazingly, nobody was killed, although several people were seriously injured. The key thing, really, I think, about that, if you read the book by Howard Fast, where Pigskill USA, which is kind of the standard book about Pigskill, it's not much bigger than my book, it's a pamphlet. What he describes is they were minding their own business, and suddenly they were convinced they were going to die because they were in the middle of a war zone. And if you've ever been on a demonstration where it's turned ugly, especially when it's been attacked by the far right, you'll know exactly what he means. It's not, there's no great build up, there's no drama. You're minding your own business, and all of a sudden there's rocks going over you and fire and all sorts. And you really get a sense of the sheer terror of these people. Paul Robeson didn't make it to that concert because he couldn't get in. They barricaded the entrance. But if he'd have been in, it's fair to say that the 27th of August 1949 would have been his public lynching. That's what they were
after. Because that's exactly what they were after, right? They were exactly. Specifically wanting to lynch Paul Robeson.
Yeah. the cries and both riots were specifically bring us out that big N-word, you know, let's string Robeson up. Robeson had become the bête noire of the American right at this point. So that was the first riot. The really interesting thing is what they did about it. Because they decided they weren't going to take this lying down and mobilized. I think this is a magnificent story. And I should kind of emphasize that I'm not a historian. I'm not an academic. I'm just an activist. And my book isn't a PhD thesis. What I really wanted to do.
You've done some great research, and you also were there. You were also talking to people in terms of like personal study. Yeah,
it's such a wonderful heroic story, and the thing I wanted to get across most is just what a fantastic story and how amazing these people were.
Yeah, I mean that's what my friend Paula DeAngelis, who is a historian in Australia, she says journalists often make the best historians because they tell the stories. They're used to telling stories, you know. I think that might apply to some certain musicians as well, perhaps. But anyway, please continue.
So they decided they were going to have the concert. They were going to restage it the following weekend. They got a different venue, which they got from a Holocaust survivor who happened to own a golf course nearby. They decided they were going to provide their own security. And this is where it gets quite remarkable, because they basically raised thousands and thousands of the organized working class of New York, particularly the dock workers and the stevedores, turned up to provide security. And when we came to the second concert, it was again in a venue where there was like a bowl type arrangement with one narrow road that goes to it. But they set up 3,000 of them, set up a human chain around the outside of the perimeter. And there are some pictures of this. And it's absolutely stunning. It meant that they couldn't be attacked physically. But the problem was that the high heels meant a good sniper could still pick off Robeson on stage. So when Robeson comes on to sing, about 24 of these trade unionists stand around him in a human shield on the stage so that no sniper can get through them. Wow. It's an absolutely stunning moment. One trade unionist who couldn't get on because they had enough actually burst into tears because he really wanted to do this. Wow. And Robeson later quoted it as being one of the moments where he understood that the fight against racism was a fight for black and white people. You know, it was about a united political response, and that people who weren't black were going to risk their lives in order to save him because that was what they believed in. And although he said that was a very important moment in driving home that point to him.
Mm-hmm.
So they had the concert and it went off fine, although there was a large counter demonstration outside. However, the problem was when they came to leave, the police directed the traffic, because they were out of town, they'd all come in cars and buses, and the police directed the traffic down side roads, not back out onto the main road. And they wondered why this was. Well, they found out that all along the side roads leading away from the venue were groups of attackers, groups of a far-right mob, who proceeded to stone and turn over and attack the concert goers as they left. It's an absolutely terrifying scene because they're basically stuck in a traffic jam with their windows being put in, watching people ahead being pulled out of their car and beaten. And of course, flying rocks and glass don't go together. One guy had his eye put out and had brain damage because of it. Pete Seeger, who was there, describes just lying down on top of his kids in the back of the car and letting the glass fall over onto them as the rocks rain in. The police, what police there were absolutely supportive of the riot. And there's a guy called Augie, I think it was, who was an eyewitness there, who I interviewed for the book. And he says he could remember the police directing these attackers from where they were to where there was a better place for them to attack. It was absolutely murderous. It's amazing nobody died. The police supervised the attacking of the concert goers. And it was an absolute horrific experience. It's very difficult to imagine. I mean, Pete Seeger referred to it as a long bloody alley all the way back to New York.
Because this was much, much worse than the police just absenting themselves, which they so often have done and since then and back then in when there are far right mobs attacking people. They actually really, really facilitated it.
They absolutely did facilitate it. And these attacks were not spontaneous. There had been caches of rocks placed at strategic areas during the week for this to for so that they were in the right place to attack the cars, which the police were deliberately corralling down these particular roads. So it was a coordinated attack.
Yeah, which is always a good technique if you're trying to plan a riot, to leave the piles of rocks in advance. It just sucks when the far Absolute. Right does it. But as... I've seen so many piles of rocks.
Absolutely. It's all about leadership. You can go both ways.
Yeah, you got some good rock piles in Palestine.
Yeah.
But inconveniently for in terms of riots in European cities, they're so often made out of cobblestone. So I remember just a little tangent in Rostock in 2007 when the G8 was happening in Rostock and protesters really shut it down and prevented it. I mean, the delegates had to move by either boat or by helicopter because all roads in that part of Germany were completely shut down for a week. But the police were terrified that there were going to be big riots, which of course there were, but they were trying to prevent anybody from coming in with weapons. But as it turned out, Rostock is completely made out of cobblestones. So the weapons were in every direction at your feet. So it was just very surreal to see, they've been looking for weapons all this time. And here everybody's pulling the stones up, breaking them up into fist-sized pieces and throwing them at the police. And there's nothing that anybody can do. I mean, unless you're going to pave over the city with asphalt or something. Or start arming the police.
Perhaps that's one of the reasons why the left in Britain is so much less militant in some respects, is because we tarmac everything.
Right. Maybe right. Yeah. Yep. The cobblestones are gone. But in Peekskill, it's also like, given recent events with the prevalence of people getting shot at protests in the United States over the past few months, there were no nobody was actually shooting at each other. Although on both sides of both the folks doing security in Peekskill and the folks attacking, the folks leaving Peekskill, many, many of them would have been World War II veterans who trained at using guns. And yet there that was not part of the scene.
Yeah, that's a very telling point, I think. You're right that many, many of the people there, possibly even both, were veterans. And many people there were veterans. And it's worth pointing out that... I tend to think anyway, the idea of veterans as being slightly maybe more on the right, as being, you know, American Legion types, but a lot of the trade unionists were veterans. Almost everybody there would have been veterans at that point. Everybody able to use guns, and although there were some a couple of people with rifles found out in the hills where there might have been snipers, it didn't turn into a gun battle. I think that's an interesting point. This was a riot, not a pogrom. I think it was an expression of anger, and I think that with the exception of somebody like Robeson, if they managed to catch him and they managed to sneak him out, this was an expression of rage and frustration. It wasn't quite murderous enough to do that. Fortunately, I guess. I think the important thing is, although the second concert was attacked, it had happened, and that's the really important thing. They didn't allow this right wing mob. They referred to them as fascists all the way through, but I make an argument in the book that I don't think that's quite appropriate. So I'll call them a far right mob.
But who were they? I mean, do you explore that in the book too? But who were these people? Because I mean, when we see far right, what might very well, I think, be described as far right mobs attacking people in Portland recently, and they're not. I mean, there's a spontaneous aspect to it, of course, in terms of their organizing through word of mouth and through Twitter and whatever else. And they're, of course, supporters of the president, so they have clear leadership. But then they're also part of organizations that are, at least to some extent, organized. I don't, you know, however well organized, I don't know, but groups like Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys and that plan events and get these kinds of numbers out, which isn't necessarily big numbers, but lately it's been, we're talking about low thousands of people.
Peekskill raises that question quite nicely, because the majority of the mob there were local Peekskillers who had probably never been involved in this before, but had been caught up in the sort of hysteria and the movement against Robeson. They were people who were suffering at the sharp end of an economic crisis which was not recognized. So you've got people who've lost their jobs, you've got people who have are struggling financially, you've got people who are subject to various deprivations, and they've always been people who are open to that kind of reactionary argument. But to emphasize the point I think that you're making, during the week between the two riots, there was a lot of discontent around the town of Peekskill. People went around to the colonies and threatened them, this time with guns. Supporters of the concert goers were intimidated, and I think most tellingly of all, banners and posters appeared across the high streets and all up and down Peekskill, showing the slogan. I can't say it in German, but it's "America, wake up! Peekskill did," and that is a self-conscious interpretation of a Nazi slogan, which was, I think, Germany, wake up, I think Munich did, which was something which came up in the wake of Kristallnacht, the pogrom against the Jews in 1936. So there was a self-conscious, a self-conscious Nazi element going on behind the scenes here that was inputting into it. It wasn't simply spontaneous.
Yeah.
I've never nailed it down to any particular organization. A lot of people tend to...
They never did.
No, I mean, a lot of people suggest that the American Legion and elements within the American Legion, rather than the American Legion as a whole, were the driving force behind it. But that we don't
Which
know.
Which does make sense, right? Because if you know the history of what happened after the First World War, the American Legion was instrumental all over the country in being the sort of shock troops of the FBI's raids on all the IWW offices across the country, and they were burning union halls down everywhere.
And the other sort of interesting suspicion is that the bosses, that the ruling class, the establishment, knew what was going on, and they were using it as an experiment. Howard Fast, in his book, tells the story of a group of what would appear to be agents, but certainly people in sharp suits, who watched the riot from a car on the hill and came down at the end of it and started interviewing people and said complimentary things to them about the way they'd organized it. And Fast interpreted this as being basically FBI officers or government officers who were observing what was going on. And he, in his book, which I don't entirely agree with, says that this was the US establishment experimenting with the deployment of mob violence and fascism as a social control mechanism. It was an experiment to see if it worked.
So that's, I mean, which is also entirely plausible. Given the resources involved at the, and knowing, of course, as we do, about COINTELPRO and how much underhanded kind of stuff goes on.
I make the argument in the book that I think the reason that that wouldn't have been developed was that in the late 1940s, early 1950s, the US authority or the US establishment had better methods of controlling people. They didn't really need riots. Riots are messy. They get out of hand, as indeed the second Peekskill riot did. They're very difficult to control. And in an expanding economy with growing profits and a healthy economy, there are other ways that they have of dealing with it, like HUAC. Right. Whereas I think what's interesting, if you look at what's happening now, is we do not live in an expanding economy. We live in an economy that's been a global economy that's been in crisis for at least 10, possibly 40 years. And you have a ruling class that do not have other options. And suddenly the idea of riots becomes extremely attractive to them as a genuine means of controlling people.
That's interesting. That's what we're talking about in terms of what's been going on very recently.
Going on as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Because, like, I mean, to emphasize your point about the other means of control. I mean, it's hard to overstate what a period of prosperity the 1950s was for so many people, but particularly because of the total destruction of so much of the world in the 1940s. Yeah. I mean, as people may or may not know, 50% of global industrial production was in the United States in the 1950s.
Yeah.
So everybody had most people could get a good job and that pay a good union job that paid quite well and like supported their family and healthcare and college and all that stuff.
That's right. And the emergence of the Cold War immediately post-war and the massive arms investment that came as part of that stopped the tendency of capitalism to throw up recessions every 7 or 8 years. And it actually had a basically uninterrupted capitalist expansion, uninterrupted right up until the early 1970s and the oil crisis.
Yeah, right. So then after that came a lot of different things, of course, post 1970s. But basically, among the many other things, has been a steady decline in real prosperity for so many people in much of the world. But in terms of in the United States and in the UK, that's been happening since that period that we. That in the UK they tend to use the shorthand Thatcherism, but of course we're talking about a global sort of neoliberal push and privatization.
Absolutely. And neoliberalism is a response to that falling off of the growth in the economy, the prosperity in the economy. And as you say, yes, people's real wages have been stagnating now for 30 or 40 years. And they can't, especially after the economic crash of 2008, the global states, whether that's in Europe, Britain, or in the US, they haven't got the options to buy us off. They haven't got any options. They haven't got any room to maneuver. They can't offer us any concessions.
I mean, they did. They've been doing these big multi-trillion-dollar spending packages that have largely gone to bailing out corporations, but have to some extent trickled down to us, like with these $1,200 stimulus checks and the expanded unemployment, which has since ended, and so many of us were never able to get on in the first place,
It's interesting how the pandemic has thrown out for all of its limitations. It shows what they can do in a crisis.
Right.
It shows what we can do if we're not trying to cream a bit off the top, what we can do if we just share the wealth that we all create. It's remarkable what we can do to help each other out. The problem being that that's actually not what the states are trying. That's not what the bosses are trying to do. It's not what people at the top of society are trying to do. Their primary concern is to squeeze value out of squeeze profits out of workers. And they don't really care how many of us they kill to do that, as long as they can keep their profit margins up.
But they need to be able to guaranteed domestic tranquility, right? They need to have, to some extent, that it seems like they need to have the consent of the governed in order to functionally govern. I know that this is very abstract and we haven't been in this kind of situation in many, many decades, but if things happen as projected in the United States, if there's no big bailout of society and restructuring of the division of wealth and big changes over the next few months, we're looking at the possibility of something like 40 million people being evicted from their homes. And we're already in a situation where everybody under the age of 29, where the majority of young adults in this country are living with their parents for the first time since the 1930s. 52% of young adults live with their parents. So, I mean, you can only imagine how many people would be living on the streets if it weren't for, you know, that kind of thing. But we're talking about it's just a crisis that's hard to even imagine, because it's nothing like what's been faced in this country since the 1930s.
Absolutely.
And in the 1930s, things were so bad and things got so rebellious and on a spontaneous basis that a lot of changes happened in order for the capitalist state to maintain control. You know,
I think what's really chilling about that is if you look at the 1929 crash, the Great Depression of the 30s, that was a global crisis. You were saying that quite rightly that they need some kind of compliance amongst the population in order to carry out business. But in the 1930s, globally in many places, they simply could not get that. That actually collapsed. And in fact, we had the New Deal. You had the New Deal in the States. But in fact, globally, the way out of the Great Depression was the Second World War. That's actually what ended the Great Depression, and that collapse of the economy and the difficulties that caused the states and the pain it caused people, that can lead to revolutions. It can lead to uprisings. It can lead to good stuff, but it can also lead to fascism. You know, it can go both ways. That's really important to understand.
And that has a lot to do with where we're at now, you think? I mean, in terms of like the talk about that, would you?
Absolutely. So I make the point that despite what the likes of Howard Fast and the people who were at Peekskill said, I didn't think it was fascist. I don't think that. I think fascism is not just vicious far rightism. Fascism is a particular social kind of event, a social process, which didn't apply at Peekskill. I also am cautious about using the word fascist, say, for Donald Trump. I know in casual language, when you're just raging at the guy, to call him a fascist is powerful. But up to this point, I don't think Donald Trump actually counts as a fascist. I would have been much more firm on that even a year ago. In fact, in the book, I'm quite firm about it. I think you can see that he's moving in the direction of fascism, but I still don't think he's fascist. And I think the people who get frustrated and say America's under a fascist government, that's not true. And I think it's dangerous to make that decision, because if America was under a fascist government, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But we are. Now, it doesn't need to say that America, the US, is not under tremendous political danger, and that this may not be a path towards fascism, or indeed that Donald Trump may not become a fascist. Certainly, when you get to the point of wondering whether or not a president will accept an election result, you've gone down a very authoritarian route. But I think that the key thing is, because the global economy is really, really in trouble, and they cannot get out of it. If you take the economic crisis, the debt crisis of 2008, which is still not resolved. You take the ecological collapse, which they can't deal with. You take now the pandemic, which they can't deal with. You reach a point where the center collapses and the state can't hold. They have no ideas. They can't buy us out of this. And what that opens up is authoritarian measures. And that is what generally leads to fascism. That leads to a genuine fascism, which is when, as the system collapses and you see right-wing extreme organizations emerge, coming from people who can't find their way out of this, coming from people who are simply driven to madness by watching their businesses collapse, by watching their kids not being able to get anywhere, watching their savings being wiped out. The ruling, the bosses, will use those to form a coalition. They will form a coalition with, and they will crush any resistance from the workers. And they will basically, you've got fascism is capitalism without any working class pushback whatsoever. It is authoritarian capitalism, because there's still bosses under capitalism. You know, Krupp's made a lot of money out of the Second World War. And we are not there yet, David, but the ingredients are there on a global scale.
And it's like there's so many similarities in terms of past, in terms of like establishments that are where there is sort of a center left or a liberal kind of establishment that's just unable to rise to the occasion in terms of the needs of the working class. Like, I mean, if there were a capitalist liberal establishment in places like the US or the UK that could just say, okay, we're suspending mortgages and rents for the next 2 years, which would be such a massive hit to the to their whole, I don't know what the ramifications would be, but for the working class, it would mean the difference between basically prospering and barely struggling to survive.
But I think the contradiction there is that those liberal left formations, wherever they are only if they are reformists. They work under the rules, the logic of capitalism. And what you just suggested is absolutely contradictory to the rules of capitalism. Ultimately, I think it's, you know, what you need is a movement of workers, a proper socialist approach where we're not interested in the needs of the top 1%. We do the work. We make the stuff. We will distribute it to as we think is right. That's really the answer to this. You know, it's
Jeremy Brecker, the historian Jeremy Brecker, was talking when I talked to him a couple months ago. And he was talking about how at the beginning, the movement, the left movement that rose up in the U.S. in the 30s started with more of the gatherings of the unemployed around anti-eviction. And basically preventing, they ultimately had to ban forced evictions in different parts of the country because of this the militancy of this sort of movement that later sort of morphed, later the labor movement and actual unions became a much more significant part of the overall movement, but it started out being more like a bit spontaneous.
I think it was in Chicago, one of the strikes. I can't remember the exact details, but yes, they mobilized a lot of the unemployed to act as basic militias to help them out on the picket lines. The other thing, which I think that the communist, the CPUS inspired left did, which was superb in the 30s, and I've got issues with their general political stance, but they were fantastic in terms of working across race boundaries. They worked with people of color and out in the agricultural workers. They did loads and loads of work for that. They were superb at defending people who were on trumped up charges and all sorts. And they built a lot of connections there. Well, I think if you want to, the lessons of history in the 30s, I think that's the most important one, is if it comes from Germany during the early 1930s when Hitler was rising to power. Hitler was a fascist, obviously. Hitler, people sometimes say Hitler was elected. Hitler never won an election. It's not true. He wasn't elected. And you had a massive organized working class in Germany, the biggest one in history, but it was split two ways. It was split between the Social Democrats. It was split with the communists. And if they had united together, disregarded their other differences, but simply worked on the basis of stopping fascism, Hitler could not have come to power. But the communist inspired, the Moscow-led communist, refused to work with the Social Democrats. And that opened the space for Hitler to come into coalition with the ruling classes and sign both their death warrants, really. And I think if there's one thing that I would like, I hope the book makes the point of, is that whatever the differences between now and then, the point about Peekskill was it was a mass organized working class defense of their own interests and a defense against racism. It was a very mixed, there weren't a lot of women in it, but it was very mixed. There were lots of black and white people mixing up on those second demonstrations. And not every one of them was a card-carrying member of the CP. These were just working class people acting in their own interests, but organized politically. And I think that's the lesson to be taken from it. That's how you fight fascism. It's got to be an organized, united response. And that's as true now as it was back then. And watching things on the Black Lives Matter movement unfold in all of its multitude of glorious contradictions is an illustration of that, you know?
Mm.
I think there are lots of folks on the Black Lives Matter demos who started off from a position that it was a struggle for black people by black people, who have learned learned quickly that it's much more effective if you've got everybody standing next to you.
It's expanding in so many ways, and because there's also so many obvious, connections that people continually make between, because I mean the whole if Black Lives Matter, then the cost of housing matters. Yeah. Of course, if Black Lives Matter, then et cetera, et cetera. It's just, it comes down to everything, because it seems like whatever's going on, Black people are being disproportionately affected by it, whether it's the pandemic or economic situation.
What's to be hoped for is that you get this, you know, get a spontaneous uprising of rage. Well, people say it's spontaneous because they haven't been paying attention to the inevitably long lead up that's gone. They just don't notice it. So when finally it comes together, that the people rise up and say, I've had enough of this, people say, oh, it's remarkable, spontaneous.
Always.
Press tactic. No, it's not. You just didn't pay any attention. But if that can be, that letting off of steam can act as a safety valve. Like the movement can blow off steam and then return back. And what's to be hoped is that they can develop some kind of leadership, some kind of political perspective that they can use to drive home real changes, rather than it just being an expression of rage or a demand from the powers that be to change things on our behalf, rather than lobbying, demanding with force behind you. I think that's really interesting that kind of the initial political demand, or the initial demand they came up with, was defund the police.
Mm.
Which I think is very, because that's a very political, that's a political demand. That asks a lot of questions about the role of the police and the role of the state.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and that's really important. And it's I certainly hope that that all of these movements, Black Lives Matter movements and the other resistance, can kind of develop that political perspective and start working with power. And certainly those, you know, it's something which we should all be involved with. And even if we have many differences with those people, when they're standing up for their rights, you stand beside them. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Russ Chandler, it has been a great pleasure talking with you for the hour.
Wonderful, David.
There's so much more ground to cover, but we'll just stop there for now.
One day we will have a pint in Northeast London again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And talk to you soon.
It's been a pleasure. Hold the line.
Yeah, absolutely. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And thanks, everybody, for joining in on this discussion with Russ Chandler in Walthamstow in London, England there, author of this wonderful book, which you can find online. If you just look up Russ Chandler and Peekskill, you'll find Hold the Line, Lessons of the Peekskill Riots of 1949. And there are many lessons for today. On Friday, I'll be back doing another interview with a fantastic hip-hop artist from Rochester, New York, named Ellie Arbor, and who's also been has got lots of perspective on ongoing protests that have been happening in Rochester, one of the key spots of ongoing events in the U.S. over the past few months. And then on Saturday, I'll be broadcasting for most of the afternoon, not probably on Kabu or on the Popular Resistance, but on my own little channels. I'll be live streaming for the afternoon from Big Red Studio. And then on Sunday at 1 Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, I'll be doing a little concert for the virtual New York City Anarchist Book Fair. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Get to meet your neighbors. Talk to you soon.